Hello, and welcome to the History of the Cards. Bonus episode 10. Interview with Dr. Urs Müller. So, I've been waiting for so long for this point in our podcast, just so I can bring Dr. Urs Müller into the conversation. Modern dedicated scholarly works about Coptic history can be literally counted on hand. Dr. Urs Müller is one of the few experts in the whole world on the subject, and I could not wait for him to share his insight with the whole world. He is a scholar of Middle Eastern and Islamic history with over 20 years of experience living, working, and researching in the Middle East. He has an MA in Middle Eastern Studies from Harvard University and a PhD in Middle Eastern and Islamic History from the University of California in Santa Barbara. And he wrote one of the main sources for our upcoming period, a book titled Coptic Identity and Ayyubid Politics in Egypt, 1218 to 1250. Dr. Urs Müller, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really appreciative. First and foremost, that you've been doing this podcast. All of us who are interested in the long view of Coptic history are delighted for any opportunity like this for more of the public, the interested public, to be exposed to this, you know, fascinating history going back nearly 2,000 years. And of course, I'm delighted that you finally made it to this point of the podcast. I don't want to say that I've been impatiently skipping forward through everything to get to this point, but that probably is not an exaggeration.
Yeah, it's been a long journey, and thank you. So for our listeners, we just ended the narrative of the Fatimids and the ups and downs of the Copts during the reign. Now, from a big picture perspective, what would you say the major changes that happened in the Coptic identity? You know, from the day that Jawhar, the Fatimid general, entered Egypt in 969, to the day Salah ad-Din taken the reign, almost exactly 200 years later, in 1169. You know, the big insights one should take away from that era.
Sure. Well, there's a few different ways to look at this, of course. One of the ways of thinking about this period in terms of Coptic identity, I use the term here, Coptic identity, very, very broadly, encompassing lots of different ways of thinking about it. If we think about this particular period during the Fatimids, one way of looking at it is that this is one of the first times, in a sense, that the Coptic community was, found itself under this, large regional empire with its base in Egypt. Before this period, of course, they had been living for a few hundred years at this point under Islamic rule, which, as you've been covering the podcast, of course, had its various ups and downs and complexities. But this was a different kind of moment, of course. This is a moment when you have this, in the beginning, certainly this very successful, dynastic order that takes place and decides to put down its roots right there in Egypt. And then to look for areas to expand, up north into Palestine and the Levant, even, having ambitions to go all the way over toward Iraq at some point. And yet their roots are there in this new city of Cairo. And so now being in a sense at the center of things rather than at the periphery is a new kind of experience in a sense. Again, during these different periods that you've covered, even before the Fatimids, Copts, like other Egyptians, had been experiencing these different kinds of political ups and downs. They, of course, for some time before the Fatimids, had lived under this semi-autonomous system with the Tulunids and others, who were nominally under the rule of the Abbasids. But, of course, they very often did their own thing up to that point. Before that period, one of my favorite stories that emerges in that pre-Fatimid period, this was under the Tulunids. And I actually want to read you a little bit of a quote here. And this is from Khomarowe ibn Ahmed ibn Tulun. So the famous Ibn Tulun, you know, lots of those running, lots of listeners who have spent time at Cairo are familiar, of course, with the Ibn Tulun Mosque, a really magnificent sacred space. But his Ibn Tulun's son, of course, was another ruler in this, we can call it kind of a mini dynasty. And what's really fascinating, as this local semi-autonomous ruler, we have this really interesting moment that we find recorded in the history of Abu Mukarram, who used to be falsely attributed to Abu Salah, the Armenian. Let me read this to you here. Well, I'm sorry. This was actually originally from the Muslim historian Ash-Shabashti. Fascinating source if your listeners have a chance to read this. But the son of Ibn Tulun used to love to visit the Qusair Monastery, which, had, you know, it's no longer in existence, but at the time was just outside of Misr Fustat. And he, as the account says, he used to like to ride out there from time to time. There's a little bit of an implication in the text that this monastery perhaps had made a particularly nice vintage of wine, which he liked. But here's what it says. He liked to go to the monastery because, and I quote, "In its altar, there is a portrait of Mary with the Christ, peace be upon him, in her lap. People visit that spot to see that portrait. In its upper part, there is a hall, which Abul Jaysh Humerawa ibn Ahmed ibn Tulun built, with four windows looking over four directions. He was a frequent visitor of that monastery, an admirer of the portrait, which is in it, and he used to drink as he watched it." So it's this fascinating, you know, scene of this, you know, very, you know, well-established Muslim ruler who liked to go out to this monastery and spend hours gazing at this icon of the Virgin Mary with a glass of wine in his hand. It's such a fascinating scene, and it gives us a little bit of a sense of some of the, you know, complexity that life was like, you know, in this era. But I digress a little bit, and, you know, stepping forward a little bit to the Fatimids, you know, here now we have this empire, this dynastic empire that's taken root in Egypt. And at roughly the same time, this is really the moment in which, if someone had taken a census at the time, and of course they didn't, but if they had, the best estimates, and I realize we'll come back to this a little bit later, but the best estimates suggest that it was probably around this time, around the 10th century, when the Fatimids are coming into their own, that the Christian population of Egypt has probably fallen into the demographic minority. In other words, there's probably at this point more Muslims than Christians. It's impossible to know exactly when that switch happens, but it's probably around this time. Mm-hmm. And so now we find that the Coptic community is in a diminishing demographic community. And now it finds itself in the center of this new empire that is, you know, vying for power with other Muslim forces around the Middle East. And so that makes for a really fascinating moment in a sense. And you know, as you've discussed already in the podcast, that era of the Fatimids is up and it's down. It's got some, in a sense, some of its highest moments as a community and in a sense, some of its very lowest. Fascinating for historians, must have been incredibly difficult and incredibly insecure, of course, to live during that period of time.
That's great. I mean, like you said, it was a period of ups and downs. And like I said, if you combine the period just before it, and then with the Ptolemies, and then the transition, which is very chaotic, and then getting into the Fatimids and the high of moving the mountain, and then the lows toward the end of it during the transition as well, it makes for a fascinating narrative. Now, there's a beautiful passage from your book that I would really love if you could elaborate on. I'm going to quote it and let you fill the background, especially as it relates to what is our medieval Coptic identity, if such thing existed, and how it relates to the wider Islamic or perhaps Egyptian identity. So here's the quote. "In this context, as well as throughout the Islamic Middle Period, non-Muslims often found themselves pressured and yet privileged, marginalized and yet integrated, broadly shaped by external forces, and yet often clearly acting rather than merely reacting through internal agency and conscience. They may not have always been masters of their own sociopolitical destiny, but they made a bold bid for it and left their impact on a wider society as a result.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I'm glad you like that passage. As I recall, I spent a lot of time poring over that one, and as you can imagine, went through a lot of revisions. But, you know, here's what this boils down to, Jonathan, is there's a really key word in here, and that's the word agency. And this is the word that I really want to focus on here. You know, to give you a little bit of a background, going into this history, when I began to really dig into medieval Islamic history, which is, you know, is my sort of disciplinary focus coming in, and particularly wanted to look at the way that the Coptic community functioned within that history, I kept finding two polar opposites. One is you would find writers, and I of course elaborate on all this in much greater detail in the book. You know, one opposite would look at the Copts in utterly, utterly dismal terms. You know, by this time, the apocalypse had come and gone. The Copts were, you know, under the thumb of the Mitude. They had no personality, no identity outside of what it meant to be under that repression, and so on and so forth. The other polar opposite was, you know, as people of the book, they were protected. They were treated fairly under Islamic law. Everything was great. The end. And I didn't like either of those polls. And especially, you know, once I got away from the established narratives that have, you know, that's beginning to change a little bit over the last maybe 15, 20 years. But in generations of scholarship past, those were the narratives that were out there. But when I actually started to look at the sources from the period, both, you know, Muslim and Christian, and I'll come back to this in a moment, other communities as well, I saw a much more complicated picture. If any of my, you know, former students happen to listen to this, I'll say past or future students, they're going to laugh when I say this, because I say it in almost every single class session, which is, it's complicated. And that's, when we talk about the Coptic community during this time, it's a complicated picture. And that word agency, I think, really helps to kind of understand the complexity, because, you know, we can't disregard, of course, the fact that the Coptic community did live under this this hegemony of Islam at this time. This is the background the rulers came from. This is the legal system that, in certain areas of life, at least, they were bound to, and that had all sorts of ramifications. But at the same time, you know, this was a very well-established community with a very strong sense of itself. Some of that sense of self, that identity, we're going to come back to in a little bit in really bold ways. And they made things happen. They didn't, you know, as I say here, they didn't just react to stuff. They didn't just sit back and say, well, you know, we're just going to wait for whoever the Sultan or the Caliph might be and see what they say, and then we'll get back to them. No, they left their stamp on the community. And that was really important for me to reflect here. You made reference, and I'm digressing back to the Fatimids again a little bit, but you made brief reference just a minute ago to the very, very famous, of course, account of the miraculous account of the moving of Mokattam Mountain. And we're going to come back. Well, I apologize that I keep saying this. I promise by the end I'll stop saying we're going to come back to it. But we'll come back to talk a little bit about the miraculous in historical accounts. There are lots of different ways of looking at those miracle accounts while still being respectful to them. And the particular account of the moving of Mokattam Mountain, one of the things that I find so interesting about it is this is not a martyrdom account, right? I mean, of course, the Coptic tradition, as you know, has such a close identity to the Church of the Martyrs, right? That in a sense, found its own sense of self during the era of Roman persecutions and then under the Byzantine persecutions, right? And it was used to being the underdog. But what's so interesting is that at this moment, when they're now under the rule of this, you know, Ismaili Shia Fatimid dynasty based there in Egypt, this account is not a martyrdom account. This is not one where the Coptic leadership or laity, for that matter, sits back and allows things to happen to them. This is one where the community prays together in the face of adversity, where they, you know, literally and figuratively stand up to the leadership. And there is an unusual happy ending to this story. And that, to me, they're all, again, there are all kinds of different ways of looking at this account. But what really strikes me about it is the sense of agency going on, where the Coptic community is making a choice to stand up, not just sitting back and letting things happen to them. And the end result is a, you know, fair sense of rapprochement with the Fatimid leadership at that point. And that's fairly striking to me.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's one of the few accounts when it's not a martyrdom account, but actually, I mean, you get the feeling like, you know, this is what we had to go through to build the church. As you know, the ending of this whole thing was the patriarch just asking for to rebuild the church.
Yes.
But so now before we start, like, proper and Ayyubid period, which is the book is really about, in general, you know, if you can you give us a little bit of introduction, what was, you know, Fustat, Misr, or Cairo, and the difference between these terminologies were like, or you can even comment on Egypt in general, like who lived there, what did he do? And for context, I last stopped with our listeners when Shawar burned Fustat down as the Crusaders were approaching, which I'm sure you're familiar with that story.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, the life of this part of Egypt at this time would have been a tremendously fascinating place. Probably a much more dynamic place than Alexandria at the time. No offense to Alexandrians that are listening today, but you know, I think at this time this was quite a dynamic community. I mean, you asked about the sort of public space we're thinking about. It's kind of hard sometimes when we think about these eras, you know, 1,000 years ago, or nearly 1,000 years ago, to kind of visualize how it matches up to what we know of Greater Cairo today. And of course, over the centuries, all the kind of spaces, the urban spaces in between have filled in as Cairo has become the megalopolis it is today. But, you know, back in this time in the early, you know, let's say into the 11th and 12th centuries, this area would have been would have been actually rather separate. There's the what at the time was an imperial city of Cairo, El Kahira, of course. And under the Fatimids, that had been a, you know, set aside for the leadership and their families. This wasn't a place where people just kind of hung out and lived and did business. That's what those, you know, beautiful city walls are for, that many of which are still standing in gates. The real kind of economic hub of the city, until the later Fatimid era, when you know, various moments of chaos allowed people to start moving in and residing in that area. But up until that time, the real kind of economic heart had been, you know, what we would think of today as Old Cairo or even Coptic Cairo, right? And this was the area where we get the term Misr. Mm-hmm. This was a port, because of course the Nile River has shifted course over the centuries. At the time, the banks of the Nile would have come over pretty close to where what we think of as Old or Coptic Cairo today. And so there was a port there going back to the Roman era, of course. And a stone's throw away from that was Fustat. That had been the original Muslim settlement just outside of Misr. And over the preceding couple of centuries, or several centuries, that had really filled in as a larger urban space, and had become, in a sense, one larger community. And what that means, though, you know, even if you go down there today, you know, you can see the close proximity that these sites are, you know, where the Mualaka church is, the hanging church is literally just around this little alley from the Ben Ezra synagogue, which was the heart of Jewish life in that part of Old Cairo at the time. And, you know, just a few blocks away is where the mosque of Amr is. And of course, that was the heart of Fustat at the time. So, you know, what that tells us is that this is a place where, you know, different religious and ethnic communities, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, they lived there. And here's what I want to encourage your listeners, Jonathan, is when we talk about this era, you know, this is a great opportunity to kind of think beyond the narrow confines of ecclesiastical history or even Coptic history in that mm-hmm. regard. One of the things when I was originally researching this book, and you know, this was dissertation research, you know, back some years ago, was the opportunity to really read and dig very widely. And one of the most fascinating sources from this period is the Geniza document. Now, this is mm-hmm. you know, sometimes siloed into Jewish history. Well, the reality is it was Jewish history. Of course, these were primarily Egyptian Jews who were keeping the documents that were part of the Geniza. But at the same time, this was also a very, very Egyptian story. And in the various documents that have been recovered and utilized from the Geniza documents, we start to see this very fascinating picture of a very mixed community. You know, we have records, for example, inventories of work projects. We have lists of rents from apartment buildings where you can see clearly from the names, there are Muslims, there are Coptic Christians, there are Jews living in these places together. And we'll even see sometimes in the records themselves, we'll see things like, you know, many of them are written, of course, in a modified Hebrew and in an Arabic script, but then with Coptic numerals thrown in. You know, so sometimes even the writing itself was this fascinating mix of people. And so that gives us a little bit of a sense of this fascinating hodgepodge of communities where in Misr Fustat at the time, you know, you know, very literally Christians, Jews, and Muslims would have been, you know, doing business in the marketplace together, buying some mangoes, you know, fighting over rental rates at this building or that one, maybe even working together on a building project. You know, we have actual material evidence of those things or documentary evidence of those things taking place. And so that should give us a sense that, you know, this wasn't a ghettoized community. This was a place where there were a lot of different people going side by side. And that's not to create a picture of some kind of, you know, interreligious paradise. You can imagine there were lots of problems that would have happened here too. You know, there were probably some fights over the wall of this mosque or that church. That sectarian stuff would surely have come in sometimes, but at the same time, there was a lot of just regular life going on of people from these different religious communities, you know, getting along because they had to, if they wanted to go about their daily lives.
It's like you said in the beginning, it's always complicated.
Exactly. You've got it.
And you know, definitely I agree with your point about the Geniza documents. Like one of the fascinating things that I learned about was the description of Ibn Kilis, the Jewish vizier who converted, matches was like in the Christian sources or even the Muslim sources, matches was what is being said in the Geniza documents. What was his role like, and you know what he was like as a person. So it's definitely an amazing source.
Absolutely, and I should add, you know sometimes when people look back at this era, you know, one of the most famous Jewish figures from the early Ayyubid period, of course, is Moses Maimonides, who of course was Salahuddin's physician and you know, this towering figure in medieval Jewish Egyptian history, of course. Now, for those who have studied this period and, you know, for those who have studied the Geniza at any length, he's not that surprising because, you know, the fact that he could play this role and such a vibrant and active role as a non-Muslim in this period and this fascinating complex role fits right in with what we see, with the picture that emerges from the Geniza document.
It's a very complex narrative, you know, between sometimes you try to tell a story of like, you know, one-sided story of what was happening in the Coptic community, but you really can't. So in order to tell the full story, like you have to find out what's going on in Abbasid caliphs in Baghdad, what's going on with the Crusader states somewhere in Antioch, in order to understand what's driving the actions of the community in Cairo. Now, one of the most difficult things that I tried to navigate in our story is, and you also touch on in the book, is the idea of demitude. and how it relates to the complexities of identities. We talked about it a little bit, but I would like for you to elaborate on it, especially that, you know, I shared a quote with my listeners from Bahrain, the Armenian Christian vizier, it was just before the Ayyubids, saying how, like, you know, Egypt is a Muslim land, yet here he was, a Christian, in all accounts, really ruling that land. Probably right next to, you know, a chief judge who was presumably familiar with all the things that a dhimmi should and should not do. And obviously one of these things that a dhimmi should not rule the land. So how would someone, you know, going into the narrative of our history, you know, navigate the concept of dhimmitude? What's a good approach? And, you know, can you elaborate a little bit on, like, you know, the theoretical dhimmitude that's in the books, so to speak, and the actual day-to-day practices?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is, and I will freely admit that I'll be continuing to overuse this term. This is so complicated, and you know, Jonathan, if there's been one thing that I have probably had the most pushback with the book over the course of the last 10 years since it was first published, it's in this question. And that's the fact that I really vehemently disagree with, you know, the way that this term at least was originally used, of course, going back to Bet Yaor's writings about non-Muslim communities under Islamic rule. And let me explain what I mean in my opposition to the term and what I don't mean. I'll actually talk about that in reverse. What I don't mean is to throw out the window the idea that there was a legal and social and religious framework of, you know, Ahl Dhimma. Of course, you know, there's no historically discounting the fact that this was an accepted standard of Islamic law in terms of the way that, you know, Muslim rulers and the sort of Islamicate systems approached and sort of established limitations around communities, around non-Muslim communities. And sometimes that came out in rather harsh and difficult and challenging, we might even say persecuting sorts of ways. There's no discounting that or disregarding that. And so my disagreement with Bet Yaor in the term dhimmitude isn't over the fact that those bad times did occur. They're in the historical record. We can't dispute that. But rather it's in terms of the way that the idea of dhimmitude becomes this all-encompassing passivity. And here, you know, again, if I go back to what I said at the beginning, that the idea of agency is really important to me when I think about the Coptic community during this time. You know, there is no disregarding the fact that, you know, they were expected to have a certain, you know, second-class citizen place in society, sure. But it doesn't mean that they were just kind of cowering in the in the corner of society like little mice, waiting for things to happen to them. And that's the, when I think of the term dhimmitude, that's the kind of visual image I get from it. It's a real sense of passivity, that this idea of being a non-Muslim is an all-encompassing identity. And I don't think that does justice to the complexity of the Coptic community, which, you know, certainly suffered a lot, but also found moments to stand up and you know, in one sense, declare itself and define itself in many ways as well. You know, just to kind of point to one abstract historical way of thinking about that, and this is not unique to Coptic history, it's not unique to Middle Eastern history, it's one of those kind of things that all historians everywhere like to think about, and that's I'm sure there's a proper historiographical term for this. I just can't think of it at the moment. But when we find in sources people in positions of power protesting conditions too vehemently, that tells us something about what's going on. Let me explain what that means here. When we find, and we do find this in.
I think I can help you here a little bit if I may. So one of the amazing things that you know, just dawned on me, that when Copts write their history, that means there is a space for them to be able to write their history. And then that means that it's not, they're not cowering in the corner as a mouse, as you just described. But in moments when it's really bad, like the, that we're going to get to it, but let's say, like, you know, the Bahari Mamluks, all of a sudden, you know, the history of the patriarchs writes only one line instead of like 40 pages, which tells you that now you're a mouse cowering in the corner, and that period specifically, for reasons that we will eventually get to, is a difficult moment. But it doesn't mean the history in its entirety is very dark. You have, like, you know, it's complicated, there's ups and downs, and
yes, does that make sense? Absolutely makes sense. And that's absolutely right, because, you know, here you've got the community and you know, a series of individuals writing down this history. They're making choices, right? They're making choices of what their community will remember took place during these times. You know, which, like you said, which stories to just write one line about, which stories to spend pages and pages elaborating on. You know, that doing history is a choice. It's an act. There is an interpretation in what's left in and what's left out. And that goes for these, for Coptic historians or chroniclers themselves at this time. And it goes for lots of other, you know, historical perspectives, as well. If we look at it from the side of the Coptic Christians who are recording that history, we see one side. On the other side of it, that is the, you know, theoretically the kind of Muslim overlords over the system, to kind of use a crass term here. If we think of it this way, we find in both the Coptic chroniclers and in Muslim historians of this period, or later ones that are using sources that we no longer have, people like El-Makrizi, who remain endlessly fascinated with, they constantly point to these moments where usually kind of local, very local rulers order that these Vimy restrictions are instated, you know, that, you know, things like priests have to wear these heavy crosses, you know, Christians can't be riding on mounted steeds and so on and so forth, things that I know you've already covered. Historically speaking, when we see that restatement of those restrictions, that tells us that that in most cases, the rulers felt the need to restate it, which suggests that people were not obeying those restrictions. And that's kind of there's a certain law of entropy going on here with society, that over time, people just go about their daily lives. You know, regular people on the ground, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, whatever, they're less concerned with these kinds of, high stated restrictions and limitations and legal ideas as they are of just, you know, getting to the market, you know, buying some figs and some rice and going home, hanging out with their family and their friends. That's what most people are concerned with. And so when we find those moments where this, you know, local magistrate vehemently stands up and says, we need to put the Christians back in their place, so we need to make sure they start, you know, obeying the Pact of Omar again, that tells us that he felt the need to reinstate it because people were ignoring it. And so that's, you know, when I talk about that complexity here and this, when we talk or we use the term vimitude too rigidly, you know, and I'm not opposed to people using the term, of course, but when it's applied too rigidly, as if this, you know, really actually determines the way that real people always lived their daily lives in 11th, 12th, 13th century Egypt, that's kind of missing that very fascinating, messy human complexity that would have been going on at the ground at the time.
Now, on the other side, there was an element, I want to say, you know, mob pressure, where, for example, you know, a church would be built and you hear it all the time, the mob would rise up on its own without a policy stated, or even sometimes the governor would be even against it, and then they would destroy that church because they're taking the enforcement of Dimitu on their own. So I guess, like I said, like you probably said, it's quite complicated, and it swings back and forth depending on the period and the economic conditions and who's ruling and all that. Now, before going on to like the center of our story, which is the Ayyubids, if you would like Can you take a little bit of time to talk about the sources that informs us of what's happening in that period? Specifically, you know, if you tell Coptic history, one of the main sources is the history of the patriarchs, which, as you put it, as in many ancient and medieval texts, the miraculous and moralizing elements, which are frequent but by no means dominant, along with its focus on the Coptic Orthodox patriarchs, have likely discouraged historians from taking it seriously as an authoritative source. So this is the dilemma, right? You have this great source that tells you a lot of details, but in the middle of these details have all kind of miracles and, you know, hagiographic stories and saints. So how can one approach sources like that? And should we take the history of the patriarchs at its word?
Yeah, this is a really great question, and it's a fascinating one. And I'll have to say up front, the way I'm going to answer this is really ambiguous. And this is sometimes, you know, the way we're kind of forced to think of things historically is with a certain amount of ambiguity. Let me explain what I mean by that. It's important to me, you know, as a historian, as a person who is, you know, both professionally and personally, you know, invested and engaged with the Coptic community. It's important for me to, at a very human level, to respect these sources. You know, the community at this time, you know, going back to what you just said about the way that the Coptic chroniclers chose to record this history, they made the choice to record, you know, I'll go back to the example again of the moving of Mokattam Mountain. They made the choice to record this history in this way. And who am I, you know, 1800 years later, or I can't do math, so however many years later, there's 1,000 years later.
Yeah. Who
am I to now sit back and just, you know, poo-poo that this happened? Well, that's first of all, I think that's disrespectful to the community, and it's disrespectful to the sources, because that was a choice that they made here. When we look at that, there's so much fascinating history that comes through the recounting of those stories, that in a sense, the miraculous nature of it, that's a matter of faith. That's a matter of faith for the community, and that's fine, and I respect that. But there's also so much else going on in that story in terms of the way that the community chose to record and chose, and this is a phrase I use a few times in the book, this is the way the community chose to remember this time. You know, again, they chose to remember this not as a martyrdom account. They chose to remember this in a very celebratory kind of way. What really strikes me, Jonathan, and you know, as you asked particularly here about the history of the patriarchs, it's of course not the only source from this period, but it's probably the most useful, because it covers such a long period of time and goes into such tremendous detail. And what I find really fascinating about the history of the patriarchs is how little of the miraculous actually comes through in the text, which makes the moments where it's recorded that much more striking. I'd like to say I can count on one hand. I can't remember everything that I read through back when I researched through the book, but you know, the fact that a couple of accounts really kind of stand out to me in which the miraculous is integrated into that story tells me something about how important those stories were in and of themselves. I mean, there's the moving of Mokattam Mountain. Another story that comes to mind is this really fascinating one. Also from, interestingly enough, from during the Fatimid period, of Wadiyah ibn Raja, who's this fascinating convert from Islam to Christianity, who becomes an important figure in the Coptic church at that time. And after a whole lot of adventures during his life and some controversies, ends up essentially, you know, dying of natural causes. He isn't martyred. He isn't... doesn't fall afoul of the wrong mob and have the church burned down on top of him or anything like that. He, you know, kind of dies of a fever or something like that. And this is a story where his conversion account in the history of the patriarchs is surrounded with, surrounded with miracles. And I apologize if I miss a few of the details here. The account is in the History of the Patriarchs for all to read. But the way it's reported,
I have an episode about him. But basically, if just to remind the listeners, he was traveling to Mecca to do pilgrimage, and then he got lost. And then miraculously, somehow, while he's lost in the desert, he traveled, presumably a saint with a horse took him, and he ended up in a church in the middle of Cairo. And he converted, and then the story goes on, as Dr. Washmore will continue.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Yeah, and that's, this is the fact that these are the two stories that pop to my head that are filled with the miraculous. Shows me that they aren't just lost in the shuffle of all these other miraculous accounts in the history of the patriarchs. For the most part, it's a fairly, I don't want to quite say dispassionate, because obviously the writers of the history of the patriarchs had the people they liked and the people they didn't like, but it's a remarkably straightforward narrative. And so when these moments of the miraculous come through, it does say something to us about how very, very important and meaningful these particular moments were to the identity of the community at that time. And, for me as a historian looking back, I'd love to read those accounts, because they tell us something about the way that the community understood it, the way that they chose to remember those moments. And there's tremendous meaning in that. One last thing I'll say about this, Jonathan, is, I'm not in full-time academia, but I do teach on an adjunct basis and love to keep the connection with students going. And one of the things that I always love to come back to with my students is to remind them that when we're talking about history, regardless of whether we're talking about the 20th century or the second century or, the 11th or 12th or 13th centuries, we're talking about societies full of real living, breathing people, with all of the messiness and good and bad and everything in between that entails. And when we think about these miracle accounts, they tell us something about the real people who were hearing these stories and finding this tremendous meaning in them. And that, in turn, as a historian, I find tremendously meaningful.
And I should add as well, that the history of the patriarchs is written by a lot of folks. It's not just one person. And you can, as you probably know, as you dig deeper into it, you'll see each one has their own writing style. And some of them love to write about miracles with specific patriarchs. And some of them don't even mention any ecclesiastical history. Like the Ayyubids period, it's basically a secular history of what's going on, with some sprinkling of what's happening inside the church. And speaking of the Ayyubids, now, you mentioned that in your book that Salah ad-Din had really two main concerns of his reign. And if you understand his two main concerns, the back and forth of his treatment of the Copts would make a lot of sense. The two concerns were, back to the point, was the war against the Crusaders, and two, the reestablishment of Sunni hegemony over, Egypt and Syria. So how these two concerns play out on the streets of Cairo, specifically in how he, in his relationship with his policies with the Copts?
Yeah, absolutely. This, it's funny. I don't know whether you made reference to this offhand, but just to throw a little Hollywood connection in there, many of your listeners that might be interested in this period may have, watched the movie. I think it came out now about 15 years ago, about the Crusades, Kingdom of Heaven. There's lots of fascinating stuff to think about the movie. I actually rather enjoy it, not because it's entirely historically accurate, but there are some things that I find fascinating. At least in his sort of portrayal as a general and as a very shrewd sort of political thinker, I think they actually get Salah ad-Din fairly well.
They do a good job.
I think the Salah ad-Din that we see in the film actually bears a fairly close resemblance to what we read in the sources. However, having said that, there's this, you know, moment at the very end of it when he's taken back Jerusalem from the Crusaders, and he finds a cross toppled over, and kind of goes over and stands it back up, and gives it a little smile, and then walks away. Now, you know, as you just mentioned, and as my book talks about, his relationship with local Christians, and setting aside the Franks for the moment, with local Christians was, you know, particularly at his base of power in Egypt, was a much more complicated one. You know, as you already stated, when he, you know, first came to power in the early 1170s, he had other things in mind. He, you know, this was a fellow. He was this, Kurdish general who would kind of, what's the right way to put it? I don't want to quite say manipulated, but he had, you know, he had played the system, you know, to get into his position, his family connections, his military connections, very shrewdly. And you know, among other things, he was a brilliant gamer of the system. And when he found himself in power here, it was really important that he establish his legitimacy at the same time that he's fighting this fight on the front lines in other parts of the region. And so, you know, that meant, and here we come back to this idea that we talked about a little bit earlier of the kind of roller coaster, the way that restrictions on non-Muslims or the Pact of Omar, you know, concept. That I know, I realize it's got its own historical issues, but people in the, you know, late 12th century certainly took the concept seriously. So the idea of restrictions on non-Muslims, you know, one of his early acts there as he was establishing his center of power in Egypt was to rather harshly reinstitute these restrictions, again suggesting to us that they had probably kind of fallen by the wayside in the years prior to that. And so his time, you know, initially was rather, you know, problematic. But having said that,
would you say that early on, basically his base was the Sunni elements in Egypt, which by no means they were a majority, but there were also, as you know, like Armenians, Copts, Shia, and all kind of ethnicities, especially in Cairo, Sudanese troops, which he had a minor interaction with. His base was basically the Sunni base in Cairo, and him doubling down and all the restrictions was his way to gain legitimacy and appeal to them.
Oh, would that be absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this is his way of declaring, look, I'm in charge now, and you have every reason to trust me. Look, I'm doing all the things that a good, strict Sunni Muslim ruler is supposed to do. And that meant all kinds of things. It you know, on one side, that meant that he took over a number of sites that had been, you know, important to the Ismaili Fatimids, had a number of them changed over, and also founded some new places that were Sunni centers of learning, including, you know, famously converting Al-Azhar to a Sunni institution from a Shia one. But he also established a number of Sufi places of worship. You know, and that the Sufi sites that he established, you know, suggest to us that he was appealing to the Islamic judges. He was appealing to the other military folks, but he was also appealing to the masses for whom the, you know, Sufi orders had become very, very important at the kind of social level by this time. So he was trying to really broaden his base of support at home, and that meant jumping through these hoops that would very publicly demonstrate how he was doing all the things that a good, pious Muslim ruler was supposed to do. And, you know, that establishes his legitimacy at home. It allows him to have the kind of, you know, political and military capital that it takes to maintain, or to build, I should say, you know, a solid unified military front that he uses to push back against the Crusaders. You know, both of those things are really playing into it at this time. So especially when he first comes into power in the 1170s, those things are chief on his mind as he's establishing his rule. But what's interesting, and this just so epitomizes how complicated it is to talk about the status of non-Muslim communities, not the least of which are the Copts at this period of time, because the same ruler that starts off with this rather you know, strict restrictions on the Coptic community. By the end of his rule, and, you know, let's face it, by the time that it's very clear that, you know, he's become Inasur Salah ad-Din, right, the victor of Salah ad-Din, not just this up-and-coming ruler, but somebody who's actually demonstrated and succeeded, we find that he actually starts to really ease up on those restrictions. Let me read you a little bit of a passage. This is a this is from History of the Patriarchs, while we're sticking with the theme, that I'll just read to you here. And apologies for the stilted translation. This is from, in my book, I like to use the translations that were already there. And this was one of them. And affairs continued to be depressed in spite of the prayer of the Holy Patriarch Mark. And he was contending for his people and his flock until God set right for them the heart of their sultan through the blessings of his prayers. And he, the sultan, that is Salah ad-Din, caused them to draw nigh, to come close, and he favored them. He employed them in his diwan and the finances of his state, and he was gracious toward them. And they returned to a higher state than they had before. And they rode on horses and mules. They wore light turbans and festal garments. And then their fortune increased, and their bodies became sound, and their sons and daughters multiplied, and their treasuries were filled with good things, and their affairs improved, and their hearts were cheered, and their breasts were expanded, and their word was influential with the sultan. So, you know, it's a remarkable picture here of what's going on that, you know, in a sense, because the reality is for the Coptic community, as you've, you know, rightly come to a number of times in the course of your podcast, it's really the times of that social and political and economic upheaval when lots of things are kind of going bad in the country that Copts suffer the most. And here we see that, you know, once that stability in the early Ayyubid era is established, we find that those strict limitations and restrictions, that state, if I can, you know, poke and prod a little bit here, that state of dhimmitude is now thrown out the window as Salah ad-Din becomes a more seasoned, more stable ruler in his lands. And we find the Copts are returning back to as if there weren't any of these restrictions at all. And that's in the History of the Patriarchs recording it as such. And that I find just that up and down, that kind of roller coaster, I just find endlessly fascinating.
The two faces of his early reign and late reign, you know, make perfect sense when you see him as when he first came to power. He's a 29-year-old ruler with no legitimacy, fighting a war against the Crusaders, and Egypt have been in disarray for multiple decades now before him. So he has no legitimacy. So he appeals to his base. But once he defeats the Crusaders and he's, you know, the great Salah ad-Din, he no longer needs that. So he eases up on them, which makes a lot of sense.
And, you know, sorry, Jonathan, I have to digress a little bit here because, I can't really hide the fact that I find Salah ad-Din just such a fascinating historical character, and the sources about him are so fascinating. But let me kind of point to one other moment that kind of shows this is what's going on in his rule at this time. His very famous biographer, Ibn Shaddad, who writes this incredibly glowing account that lots of people have used over the years to talk about his life. And there's no doubt, you know, this is a writer who's certainly trying to curry favor with Salah ad-Din and wants to, you know, kind of kiss up to him. Fair enough. But having said that, he records this really fascinating exchange. And this is at the time when, you know, Richard the Lionhearted, you know, has come over from Europe and is waging his war on trying to take back Jerusalem from Salah ad-Din. And he's holed up at, I can't remember if it's Ascalon or one of the cities along the littoral plain in Palestine. And there's this really famous moment where they're coming up to the winter. Both sides, both armies have kind of come to a bit of a status quo after a little bit of back and forth from both sides. And Richard writes this letter to Salah ad-Din. Interestingly enough, those letters are conveyed by Al-Malik Al-Adil, who's, you know, succeeds to the Sultanate of the Ayyubid dynasty after Salah ad-Din dies. It's his brother. And in this letter, Richard says, hey, look, you know, if we don't settle this now and you give me these cities along here and just kind of give up, I'm gonna winter here and then I'm going to have reinforcements coming from back home and you're going to have to fight me again this year. And what's really fascinating is Salah ad-Din's response. It's just, it's brilliant. It's so confident. He sends this letter back, conveyed through his brother Al-Adil, and he says, sure, why not? You know, look, if you think it's fine to hang out here through the winter, be my guest, because you know what? I'm home. You know, I'm here in my own lands. I'm surrounded by my kids and my grandkids and my family. And I've got a whole, you know, I've got a whole army behind me here that's going to be resting up at home as well. When the spring thaw comes, we're going to be, you know, at full strength, ready to fight you guys. And I'm quite happy to wait it out here if you're happy to wait it out. And as it turns out, not long after that, you know, Richard heads home. I don't want to quite say it was because of this letter, but what I find fascinating about it is that in this letter, we see that same sort of relaxed and very, very confident Salah ad-Din, who clearly knows his place at this point. And it's that same Salah ad-Din that here in the latter part of his rule, back home in Egypt, has said, okay, everybody knows I'm in charge here. I don't need to keep showing off my legitimacy in a sense, and eases those restrictions. And, you know, the Coptic community, as reflected in history of the patriarchs, they recognize that. They see that going on, and they recognize that, you know, they can kind of go back to ignoring those restrictions as they had before.
So can you comment a little bit on the political? So we talked about the military like aspects of his rule, but can you comment a little bit about the political organization of the dynasty that he eventually sets up? You know, for our listeners, eventually Salah ad-Din would move on from vizier, where we last stopped, into proclaiming himself to be the sultan, not as a caliph, as the Fatimids, not taking place of the Fatimids, or not even replacing the Abbasids. But it was something similar to, you know, what the Seljuk warlords were doing. So can you, the Tour Smaller, can you comment on what did that practically mean? And, you know, how was the dynasty set up and the relationship between the sultan and the various local rulers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when we talk about Salah ad-Din, you know, when he comes to power, he is, you know, very much part of what we talk about as the Zangid order, which in and of itself is a successor to the Seljuk kind of political framework. In and of themselves, all those things are very fascinating contexts that we it's probably a little bit beyond what we want to talk about today, but it was certainly the Seljuks who had set up power in the Abbasid heartlands, you know, a couple of generations previously. They're really kind of the innovators here, where once they, you know, came down to Baghdad and really established themselves as a preeminent military and political force, they understood that it was going to be awfully hard to pass themselves off as religious rulers, because very clearly, among other things, there was no way they could pretend that they were direct descendants of the Prophet or of his family, as the Abbasid dynasty, of course, did claim to have those roots. There were lots of reasons for it, but you know, the Seljuks innovated the system where they said, "Look, we're gonna continue to recognize the religious legitimacy of the caliph, right? He's the Khalifa, he's the successor to the Prophet, but we instead are going to be the ones that wield the sulta, the earthly power," is one kind of loose way of translating it. And so the sultan, the wielder of the earthly power, is, you know, very much the political leader. And it's very clear by this time the Abbasid caliphs don't really wield a whole lot of power apart from that kind of symbolism. And, you know, that's that system that, you know, a few generations later, Salah ad-Din inherits and finds tremendously useful, because, you know, as he is gathering his armies to fight against the Franks and, you know, pushes forward with that war and successfully retakes Jerusalem, an important part of his legitimacy in unifying, not all, but a good portion of those armies, was that he actually appealed to the Abbasid caliph and said, look, you know, I'm gonna wage this war against the foreign invaders here, of the Crusaders, and I want essentially your blessing, right? I want your word that this is a legitimate perpetration of the armed form of jihad, right? That, you know, the Muslim community is facing an existential threat here. And, you know, we want to be able to invoke that concept here. And which, of course, was not just something, not a term people could just throw around. It needed legitimacy and weight behind it. And he said, you know, and I want you to also recognize me as the leader of that effort. And, you know, so the Abbasid caliph at the time, I can't remember offhand who happened to be in charge, but, you know, sends him some black robes and sends him a letter sealed with the Abbasid seal and signet ring and things like that, you know, denoting, you know, we recognize that you know, you can wield this military and political power. And so it's noteworthy that even after he has, you know, carried out some rather important victories and established hereditary rule back at home in Egypt and then up through Palestine and Syria, Salahuddin, being the shrewd political operator that he is, finds that quite sufficient. He doesn't attempt to claim some kind of bigger religious role than he has. He's quite happy with saying, you know, I'm the person with political power, and that's all I really need. So this system of the separation between the caliph and the sultan, you know, a position that later on the Ottomans are quite successful at essentially reuniting these two concepts. This was the system that Salahuddin inherited and used to great effect. So I don't want to quite say that it was a separation of mosque and state, but it was certainly a recognition of different roles of religious leadership and political leadership. And that's the kind of framework or approach that Salahuddin and his successors throughout the Ayyubid era continue to adhere to.
Now, after Salahuddin, his successor would come in, and there would be a lot of family dynamics between the brother, like the extended family, essentially. And there was also going to be some interesting dynamic between local rulers and the central administration, which would eventually... So can you comment about that tension a little bit and how did it play out like on the street, especially in like Fustat or Cairo?
So to your question about these political differences that Salahuddin had to deal with, it's a really fascinating one in that's you know, really at the heart of what made the Ayyubid system tick. You know, let me explain. In one sense, it was very clear under the Ayyubid order, starting with Salahuddin and through his successors, who was in charge, right? There was no question who the Sultan was. But what was so interesting is that really when we talk about the Ayyubid era, it's not so much an empire per se with a very strong centralized apparatus, but it was really kind of a confederation where you had a number of members of the wider Ayyubid family who each governed a district, a region of this territory from Egypt at moments, even all the way down through the Hejaz and Yemen, and then up through Palestine and Syria. So you had all these essentially big land grants that were divided out among the prominent members of the Ayyubid family. And the actual sultan, starting with Salahuddin and then Al-Adil and Al-Kamil and others after them, they were, in a sense, I don't want to quite say they were the first among equals, but it was a similar idea of that they had a very delicate balance that they had to strike with these different members of their extended family. And as a result, you know, including during Salahuddin's own lifetime, it wasn't just enough to be fighting against the Crusaders and to have established his legitimacy in Egypt. He also had to keep his extended family in line throughout his rule. And he did a pretty successful job, mainly because there was a very clear enemy, in a sense, for them to focus their eyes on. In subsequent years, as the Ayyubid era goes on, and it's not a tremendously long era, but in those decades where it's in charge, you know, we find that some of the Ayyubid sultans had to really deal with some unruly characters throughout their extended family. You know, their domain was Egypt, and that was kind of their heartland, and it was Palestine and Syria where they tended to be a kind of a big family mess of people vying for power. But that that political game was really important, a really important part of understanding how the Ayyubid era ticked. And so we find that at lots of times, we would find that the Ayyubid sultans would disappear for a while, sometimes a matter of a few years, from personally overseeing things, you know, back in Cairo, to have to deal with some family member who's trying to seize power up in Syria and so on. So it wasn't just the various waves of crusader fights that were coming into play. It was also these internal dynastic or family confederation squabbles that they were dealing with as well.
Fascinating. It's the entropy of victory, I guess.
Yeah.
So lastly, it's a bit far away from we last stopped in the podcast, but 1250 AD is kind of like a very important year because Cyril, perhaps the most memorable patriarch of that period, he dies. And there's a seven-year vacancy after him, and that seven-year vacancy ends in 1250 AD. But perhaps more importantly, the Ayyubid dynasty ends, and a new dynasty comes along, the Bahari Mamluk. And they take power, and there's significant change and consequences, especially in the Coptic community. Can you briefly comment on the Bahari Mamluks and what essentially happened when they took power to the Coptic community specifically?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is you know, there's no denying the fact that the Bahari era is a really challenging one for the Coptic community. And that's for a few reasons. One of them is that the Bahari Mamluks, their predecessors were brought in by the later Ayyubids to serve as, you know, essentially a standing army that is loyal to no one but the Sultan at the time. And that proves to be the case to a certain degree until, as you mentioned, around 1249 and then, definitively in 1250, it's very clear to these Bahari Mamluks, named as such because they were posted in a citadel down on the Rauda Island. So, you know, this was, in medieval terms, the Nile River was known as the Bah, or the sea, and so they were the Bahari Mamluks, the essentially the seaside Mamluks, mm-hmm. if you want to put it in crass terms. So they, you know, it's important to understand them and the broader Mamluk era that. A lot of times people talk about the Mamluks as the Mamluk dynasty. The reality was the Mamluks were not a dynasty at all. The Mamluk era, first the Bahri and then later the Borji Mamluks, this was a system. This was a structure. It was a framework of rule rather than a family dynasty per se. There were a few kind of mini dynasties sprinkled throughout, but not very many. Instead, what we find is this situation where you have this group of people who have been essentially trained and, again, to use kind of a crass term here, but essentially bred to be, a finely tuned fighting machine, as they demonstrate on the battlefield, certainly. But now they've been imported in as youth, raised to be these slave soldiers, later manumitted, and find themselves in positions of power. Well, you know, these are not people who are necessarily going to look particularly sympathetically at the local community, particularly those who belong to a different religious community. If we think of it a different way, the Mamluks were not raised in sort of the gentrified intellectual surroundings that we might find a typical Ayyubid prince or Ayyubid sultan has been raised in. If we look at someone like Al-Malik al-Kamil, he'd been running around Egypt since he was a youth, raised in the courts of his uncle and his father. And, knew what it meant to be seen as a, you know, fine, upstanding, well-meaning, well-educated, well-learned, well-spoken political figure or, you know, man of letters, even in a sense. There were individual Mamluk rulers who might have tried to vie for such a concept, but they weren't raised within that kind of a concept. You know, these were through and through military folks. And so, when we find that the Bahari Mamluks begin taking charge, we find this real roller coaster of political style and religious zeal and sometimes instability really kind of coming to define that era. It's fascinating. You know, there's a very good reason why so much of the the landscape or the skyline of Cairo is so defined by Mamluk architecture. They really left their stamp on the country. And that's both fascinating and good, but it also had its bad side. And unfortunately for moments during the Mamluk era, it's not every day of every year, but there were certainly some of the absolute lowest moments of the Coptic tradition come during this period. You know, we certainly see by the late 13th and throughout the 14th century, we find some of the real difficult moments come through. And often at these times of instability, when for whatever reason, there's, you know, whether there is infighting within the different Mamluk generals who are vying for power, or they're off, you know, fighting their fight against the Crusaders or fighting against the Mongols, whatever the case may be, we find these, you know, really sad, tragic moments under the Bahrain Mamluks, where the best way to characterize it is mob rule. You know, we find very clearly in the sources, such as History of the Patriarchs, later on, El-Makrizi, a Muslim historian, you know, writing 200 years later, spends a fair amount of time talking about this period under the Bahrais when, you know, it seemed quite, I don't want to quite say everyday normal, but there were too many of these moments where you would have I don't know any way to put it, but a fanatic mob would decide to come out, and this uppity priest over here or this monastery, they're collecting too much wealth, or they're being a little bit too public and prancing around on mounted steeds and whatever. So, you know, it's time for the mob to show them a lesson. And the nominal ruler who happens to be in charge of that governorate or Egypt at that time sort of throws up his hands and says, well, you know, you guys are right. You know, I'm not going to disagree with the mob. And, you know, we certainly do have some moments, you know, Donald Little's article, if anyone is interested in reading about this further, Donald Little's article on conversion under the Bahrain Mamluks is, I can't remember what year he published then, but that's really, to this day, I think still kind of the gold standard of looking at the sources to kind of understand what happened then. And it's very clear that if Christians had become the demographic minority by maybe the 10th century or so, we really see a pretty serious wave of conversion. And I think we can rightly see this as desperate Christians who see, you know, no way out from this mob violence to convert to the majority religion. And, you know, sadly, it is under the Bahrain Mamluks when we see several waves of these really harsh attacks against Christian communities. And this, so it's not just the occasional reinstatement of restrictions against non-Muslims. There's some real kind of street level violence that goes on too. And for a lot of people, it's just too much.
It's actually perfect. It leads right into my next question, which is about the topic of conversion and apostasy. So given the overall narrative of the Fatimids, the Ayyubids, and the Bahrain Mamluks, what would you say the historical or the best historical estimation for the demographics in Egypt? You kind of touched on it a little bit, but specifically, you know, what are the various series of conversion that's out there that, you know, other historians have written about? And what would you say the moment where the Copts were basically went under, you know, like 15% or 10% of the population, the modern estimate of the current demographics?
Yeah, sure. That's, you know, Jonathan, it's a very, very hard statistic to pin down, as you're aware, of course.
I mean, yeah, of course.
You know, it's one of the challenges in the 21st century or before that, the 20th century, you know, wider Middle East is the question of statistics and demographics. When you have, you know, people in positions of power who have a vested interest in keeping a status quo, they don't really want to know what the numbers really look like.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then, you know, I don't want to quite say that it was impossible because, of course, there had been, you know, we know of a very famous census that the Romans took in the first century, for example. So it's not that people didn't know how to do a census, but in such a complicated place as Egypt, to my knowledge, we're not aware of any kind of medieval census that takes place. It just wasn't particularly in the political framework of how medieval Islamic rulers ran the show, is to take those kinds of senses. So we really don't have a definitive statistical sense of that shift. You know, I note in the book that there are a couple of different theories of looking at the way that conversion happens. Some say, well, you know, conversions happen in waves. For example, I know that you've touched on a number of times in the podcast some of the rebellions that happened under the Umayyads and the early Abbasids. And, you know, there are historians who point to those and say, you know, after the crackdown that resulted from these rebellions, that's when these waves of conversion happened. I tend to, just because I, for, with lack of a definitive answer to put a finger on, I think there's a, just a little bit more sense that that kind of peeks through the edges of our sources throughout, you know, the history of the Coptic community under predominantly Muslim rule, is the sense of attrition, you know, that over time we just see, you know, we see a progressive shift over time. Now, I would say that was probably the case of this, attrition over time, that just little by little individuals, families, maybe on very rare occasions, maybe a you know, extended clan or maybe even a village might have converted to Islam. I don't think that kind of thing happened very often. I think the conversion probably happened person by person, family by family for the first several centuries under Islamic rule. Where I think we see that the shift really change is under the Bahri Mamluks, because and maybe that's a little bit of bias because of how the sources reflect these, but at least in the sources, things like the history of the patriarchs and later Muslim chroniclers, we get a sense that a lot of people converted after these waves of mob attacks and you know, very severe restrictions on Christians. Now, how we get from being a slim demographic minority to being the, you know, 10, 12, 15% that we've seen in, you know, this most recent generation of the Coptic community, it's really hard to say. You know, even the Ottomans, as brilliant as they were at bureaucracy, right? They knew how to keep records. and believe me, as someone who's studied the Ayyubids, I am very envious of Ottoman historians who actually have, you know, boxes and boxes and boxes of court documents, other sorts of things that they can point to for documentary and archival evidence. We don't necessarily see that kind of clear link from point A to point B in terms of how that happens. My guess, and I'll just call it an educated guess, I don't want to claim it to be more than that, is there are probably some waves of conversion like happened under the Bahri Mamluks, but most of the time it's probably a matter of just attrition over time. It's, you know, whether that's by real religious conviction or, as very often happens, it's a matter of convenience, it's a matter of economic opportunity, it's a matter of societal pressure. Individuals, families convert, and that number shifts over time. And that's my educated guess, is that that's how that transition ultimately happens.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like, we went through it with our listeners in the podcast, but it shows up again and again in the history. You hear about this priest converted, and probably you have assumed it's family too. You hear about, you know, there's an argument and this person was a monk and now he converted and now he goes back and persecutes the church. And that comes a couple of times in the history of the patriarchs. But I mean, obviously the two things that kind of stand out as very heavy waves, if you want to call it that, is obviously the rebellions plus the period of the Bahri Mamluks, where it was mob rule. Yeah. Now, to pivot a little bit from our discussion and take a closer look at the working of the Coptic Church, perhaps no one symbolized this period with all its ups and downs as the patriarch Cyril ibn Latlab. To show the contrast between the problems of his reign and the budding of a class of Arabic-speaking Coptic theologians, like Awad al-Assal. So can you talk a little bit about Cyril and that class of the Arabic theologians, you know, who he was and what impact did these theologians leave, arguably to this day?
So, you know, here's the fascinating thing. And I, you know, as you said, what's interesting about his period of time, not just as patriarch, but also the period of time where he was trying to become patriarch, is it really does, you know, really fascinatingly represent this very complicated period of time. I mean, you know, he's somebody who first, you know, tries to rise up from being a priest to taking the patriarchate when his predecessor died. There was a lot of opposition. People didn't think he was particularly well prepared for that position. There was a sense of, well, who are you to claim the patriarchate? It was also very clear, to be blunt, that from relatively early on, he was pretty open to the idea of paying for the position. And eventually, you know, when he comes into the patriarchate, that involves a pretty large sum of money that he had to pay to the Sultan, and then finds himself in debt and has to find ways to pay that off. So, you know, that in and of itself is a fascinating thing. But, you know, despite that inauspicious start, once he's in power, he actually tries at least to be a pretty proactive patriarch. You know, one of the arguments I make in the book is that he really does his best to try to, I don't know if expand or extend is the right word, but certainly to kind of proclaim his authority as the patriarch of the Church of St. Mark as far as he can. You know, writing letters to the Emperor of Ethiopia, which of course the church in Ethiopia was under the authority of the Coptic Church. He, you know, writes letters to the Patriarch of Antioch, talking about, you know, people from his community that live up in that direction. It, again, itself a fascinating thing. So very clearly, this was somebody who really tried to really put both feet down and declare his authority as the Coptic Patriarch. But the reality was that controversy followed him throughout his patriarchate. And, you know, the fact that he had spent so many years trying to really push for this position, a lot of people within the Coptic community at the time grumbled about it, saw the whole thing of smacking of corruption. And so that controversy was really a challenge to his authority. But what's so fascinating during this period of time, and it's hard to say whether it is coincidental or whether it's because his patriarchal authority was so disputed and so questioned, we find that lay people during this time really kind of stepped up to the bat. You know, you already mentioned the Aulad al-Asel family, who are fascinating. We have this, you know, several brothers from this family who in various ways leave their stamp on the community, who very clearly identified that the, you know, the Coptic community, you know, had a need for some reinvigoration of the way that they think about their own faith. You know, we find one of the brothers, of course, writes this big compendium of theology. If we were on video, I would pull out this stack of books that I have of his very famous compendium of elaborating on Coptic theology there in the first part of the 13th century. Another one of the brothers looked at a very real need that the Coptic community had at this time, and that's not a lot of people understood Coptic. The patriarch himself, Cyril ibn Lukluk, didn't understand Coptic, or at least he couldn't read and write it. Maybe he could understand it in the liturgy. But so one of the other al-Asel brothers started this tradition of writing, they were known as the Sulam. They were essentially primers for native Arabic speakers to learn Coptic. And it's fascinating. We have records, you know, we have actually some of these primers had been copied and passed along. We have records of some of these. And, you know, again, this is a lay person identifying this need and of wanting to really restate what it meant to be Coptic. Of, you know, as much as I spent a fair amount of time in the early part of my book saying, you know, Coptic language cannot be understood as the only locus of Coptic identity, I stand by that 100%. There's no denying that it's a component of, you know, that tradition. And so one of the al-Asel brothers says, all right, well, we're going to get back to this. And, you know, I'm going to do my best to, you know, take what's now a pretty uniform Arabic speaking community and try to reintroduce the language that they only know through the liturgy at this point. And so it's a really kind of a fascinating moment. One other thing though, that I want to mention, Jonathan, that we see at this time is we find that this isn't just in these kind of theological or liturgical settings, but we find these really fascinating cultural moments popping up in different parts of the Coptic community right now. One of the things I mentioned in my book, and I would strongly urge any of your listeners, if you're interested in this, to look up the fantastic, and it's a big, heavy book that Elizabeth Bowman and I'm all of a sudden drawing a blank on his last name, Patrick Goddard, I think it is. They did this fantastic series of photo essays and then articles with historical analysis of these amazing wall paintings at the Monastery of St. Anthony out by the Red Sea. This was now, I'm going to say, about 20, maybe 25 years ago. There was an effort to restore these paintings in the chapel of the main chapel of the Monastery of St. Anthony, which over the centuries had been covered with, you know, grime and soot and really weren't very visible. When they uncovered these and they restored these wall paintings, just something unbelievable was there underneath the soot and the grime. These wall paintings that not only are vibrant, they are these amazing statements of what it meant to be Coptic in the 13th century. And that is, you know, right at the same time that these changes are taking place, the Aulad al-Asal family are, you know, doing theology and language primers and things. Right at that same moment in time, we have this fascinating art project at this very prominent monastery out by the Red Sea, where they paint these beautiful, beautiful, you know, paintings of iconography of all the most important Coptic saints, you know, at the time would have been important. But what's interesting is a lot of this artwork is also infused with the kind of political culture of the period. You know, to you know, give an example, a couple of the equestrian or the horseback saints that, you know, over the years, you know, people like Saint Mercurius and others who were, you know, very important to the Coptic tradition. They're in these wall paintings, and yet their armor and the saddles and the braids and things of the horses are very much what you would find in one of the, you know, Turkic cavalry members of the Ayyubid era. And it's there they are embedded in these wall paintings in the Monastery of Saint Anthony. And here what we find is, you know, Coptic painters in this very prominent monastery, you know, infusing the culture of their time into this bold statement of their own Coptic saints. And it's a really, really fascinating thing.
It's one of the great ironies of Coptic history. Is like, you know, if you wanted to know what a Mamluk would look like, is you basically walk into a church and see what a horse, like a saint that is, you know, riding the horse would look like, because most of the icons that survived are from that period, and they basically reflect what these artists saw in their day-to-day lives.
Yes.
Correct?
That's absolutely right. And by the way, the name of that book, it's called Monastic Visions. Strongly recommend having a look at that. One other thing to note about that, which is pretty interesting, Jonathan, you asked a question much earlier in our talk about some of the changes that took place with Coptic identity when we think about the, you know, later Fatimid era and into the Ayyubid. One of those is the fact that it was pretty clear by the time we get to the later Fatimid and the early Ayyubid era, is it's very clear that the, you know, what we think of as the Coptic Orthodox tradition, or in theological terms, the, we might say the Monophysite, or, you know, I realize that there are some more updated terms thinking about the theology of the period, but it's very clear that they had theologically or ecclesiastically speaking won the day. I mean, we find in some of the earlier eras, as you've talked about on here, and we see in the sources that a lot of the concerns of the Coptic community, you know, going back centuries, going all the way back to the pre-Islamic era, of course, was internal among Christians, among different Christian communities, these, you know, very, very heated theological debates. And even as late as the 10th centuries, you know, there are still these theological disputes, you know, between the Coptic Orthodox Church and the what we refer to sometimes as the Melkite Church of the period, those who were still loyal to the Byzantine Church. And it's very clear by the time we get to the early 13th century is the Coptic Orthodox community is so confident in its identity that it, you know, it is now the Egyptian church. And those, you know, the Melkite community and others have really shrunk away almost to nothing at this point. And they feel quite comfortable at this point, even introducing some Byzantine imagery into their iconography, something that would have been unheard of, you know, 300 years prior. We now see sprinkled around some of the artwork. And that's really, you know, again, this fascinating infusion of influences shows, I would argue, and this, I come back to that idea of agency, I would argue that artistry shows a real sense of confidence on the part of the Coptic community at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, to me, if you look at this period and you want to link what we, like the modern period of iconography, of how the Coptic community looks at Coptic, it really comes down to this period, because if it wasn't for Awlad al-Asal and other theologians writing these, you know, Coptic, I wouldn't say guides, you know, the language would have probably been lost. It was only at this brief moment of light before the Bahari Mamluks of Renaissance, if you want to call it that, that these things were preserved. And then when the Bahari Mamluk came and we had arguably a demographic collapse, you had all these things in place already.
Yes.
That were the community can go back to and always build on.
Yes.
So with that, you know, I would really like to thank you for your time. You know, this has been an amazing discussion. And for those who are interested further, as we mentioned repeatedly, Dr. Wurstmuller wrote a whole book in just this period. It's called Coptic Identity and the Ayyubid Politics in Egypt. It's excellent. It's basically one of our main secondary sources when we start talking about this period. And I highly recommend it if you want to learn more about the characters and the context of the Ayyubid period. So thank you for listening. Farewell, and until next time.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. I appreciate the opportunity to be on here.